Good afternoon. This is Russell Stevenson with a podcast sponsored by The Mormon History Guy and Rational Faiths. We have here in studio today Alex Beam, the author of American Crucifixion, The Murder of Joseph Smith, and The Fate of the Mormon Church. In this book, Alex Beam discusses the fateful years of Joseph Smith's life, particularly those weeks leading up to his death. We discuss polygamy, theocracy, and Joseph Smith's allure to the Mormon community. Stay tuned. Good afternoon. This is Russell Stevenson with The Mormon History Guy and Rational Faiths. This is a special joint podcast. We have with us here in the studio today Alex Beam, the author of a new book entitled American Crucifixion. It is a story, and might I add, a rather riveting one, of the final days of the prophet Joseph Smith, who was the founding prophet of Mormonism. For those of my listeners who are unfamiliar with the basics of Mormon history, welcome to the studio, Alex.
Russell, thank you very much.
And good to have you. So, Alex, one question I often ask of authors is, it's a pretty basic one. You know, we wake up in the morning, and, you know, having written a book myself, I know something about this process, and you say to yourself, gosh, I need to write something about blank. And in your case, it was, I need to write something about the death of Joseph Smith. What prompted you to start having these thoughts?
Well, it's incredibly undramatic. I'm sorry. If I'm going to be undramatic, at least I'll be brief. I was offered the opportunity to write this book. The idea for this book came from a young editor at a publishing house called Bloomsbury in New York. He eventually left Bloomsbury and went to a different publishing house. But he had an ideal vision of a work of popular American history about the assassination of Joseph Smith for, like, and I'll try to be as quick as possible. I mean, he thought it would be a violent story, a profoundly religious story about a great American religion. He of course, knew that polygamy was involved, which brings in sex. It's a story in the American frontier, which not all that many people realize, that southwestern Illinois is the end of the settled United States in 1844. And lastly, he knew, these are things that he knew when he was looking for a writer, and I didn't know until I started researching the subject. He also knew that there's an extremely compact timeline here to work with, that in effect, the precipitating event that will trigger Joseph's death takes place in June 6th, 1844, the publication of the Dissident newspaper, and 3 weeks later, Joseph is dead on June 27th. So that's like the way a book editor thinks, and I got an email from my literary agent saying, I quote it, exactly, would you like to write a book about Joseph Smith? And I thought for a while, and I think I joke about this sometimes. I think I'm probably the only person my literary agent knows who's like a church-attending Christian, which he probably somehow conflated with you know, the Salt Lake City Mormonism. In any case, I was kind of, I said yes, and I started the spade work, and then I actually had to write a proposal for the book, you know, even though I knew that this house wanted it. That's it. So it didn't come, to be honest, it didn't come from within me. It came from without me.
Well, and you know, even though you think that's rather undramatic, I do think it is noteworthy that the story of Joseph Smith, it touches on a lot of resonant themes, right? You know, you speak about, obviously, sexuality, but also the frontier, about a self-made man, about a self-made religion.
Well, right. I mean, among others, as you well know, you know, I mean, Harold Bloom is like the Yale contemporary literature scholar and sort of all-round, you know, literary all-star. Yeah, has made much of the fact. I mean, he feels that Joseph Smith is the greatest American divine of any century period, and he calls Mormonism, you know, the great American religion. So, yeah, I mean, Smith, elsewhere I've called him the greatest and most successful American evangelist. I mean, there's a lot of ways you can talk about him, but he's certainly has a vivid and successful religious imagination.
Absolutely. And I was having a conversation with somebody at the Sunstone Symposium, and, you know, he is writing a book on American gurus, right? individuals who are interested in Oriental thought. And he said Joseph Smith fits within that context as well. And I think this speaks well to a comment Richard Bushman made about Joseph Smith, saying that Joseph Smith does not have a history, and that's why no man knows it. It's because he has many histories, and he fits within a number of contexts.
Yeah, no, that's a fascinating point. Obviously, who would know better than Richard Bushman, frankly? Yeah, I mean, many people try to grip that slippery stone that is Joseph Smith, and he's hard to pin down.
Certainly. So let's talk about the process of writing this book. You begin to look at, you know, maybe some Bushman. I'm not sure what the initial works were that you were exposed to. But what was your initial impression of Joseph Smith?
I guess if I were attempting to be honest, and I mean, I'm answering the question in its immediacy and also in the context of the 2.5 years. I wonder if any non-Mormon comes to Joseph Smith other than through Fawn Brody's biography. Mm. In other words, I feel like I could tap dance with you and pretend this and say, oh, I mean, in fact, okay, the literal answer is Robert Remini's kind of super small Viking short life because it's short. So, yeah, okay, fine. As if I were speaking off the record, which I realize I'm not. It's not a very good book at all, but it's really short. Remini's a distinguished, now deceased, historian of the Jacksonian era, which is bizarre because Joseph didn't really live in the Jacksonian era. But he's a close friend of Bushman's also. In any case, I think, and I know this isn't where you want to go, but this came up at the Mormon History Association where Bushman and I and others were talking. I mean, I actually use this line that Brody is the nightmare from which Mormonism is trying to awake. I mean, no one outside the religion, I think, will ever take that first approach without Fawn Brody. So I say that in any, obviously with mild apologies and in full cognizance that her story is subject to criticism.
And frankly, I think any historian of Mormonism who has, you know, done any substantive amount of research into the life of Joseph Smith, they would agree with you. They would say that Fawn Brody defined the discourse for nearly a couple generations. And you could say that, you know, Bushman was in some ways trying to revise it, but in other ways, it was a variation on the theme that Brody established.
I mean, I'm not, you know, I don't think Richard would see it that way, but someone pointed me to this amazing book he published called On the Road with Joseph Smith.
It's a fantastic read.
Unbelievable insight into how a book author really thinks. Because, sure. And it's very honest. I mean, God bless him. But he writes in that book that, now this is me talking, that he writes that if he and Knopf had been hoping to quote, this is not a real quote, but you know, knock Fawn Brody off her perch, that he failed. I mean, he writes that in a very revealing paragraph, that Brody rules. I mean, he says it with a great sense of rue.
So, in a sense, it almost sounds as if he was trying to replace Brody.
Yeah, I think so. And I think in an intellectually honest and faith-affirming way. And then I literally just wrote a long article about on this subject for the American Scholar. I mean, you know, someone like Mike Quinn hates Fawn Brody. I mean, I'm not saying that he's a person suffused with hatred, but I mean, he really doesn't like that book. So like people from all over the spectrum, not me, I would certainly say, but I mean, you know, have legitimate beefs with Fawn Brody. And I think Bushman was really hoping that 70 years later, if that's the right, you know, that finally he could supplant her as the go-to work.
So let's talk a little bit about the narrative that Fawn Brody laid out, and briefly, so that way we can get to bulk of your book. But, you know, Fawn Brody wrote her work in the mid to late 1940s, and her basic thesis was that Joseph Smith started out as a con man, a huckster, no more, no less. And over the course of time, he came to a kind of self-realization and came to see himself as a prophet and therefore came to live out his own delusions.
That is, as I understand it, that's an exactly accurate recap of Brody's position, right?
Right. So are you trying to do anything in regards to her thesis? Or are you trying to build upon it, trying to revise it? What are you trying to do in regards to Fawn Brody?
Well, in fact, in no way had an ambition to write a revision in any sense of the word of Joseph Smith. I mean, in my mind, I mean, when I call him, you know, a scryer and a diviner, I talk about what he did before he became the creator of the Mormon religion. I mean, I kind of put it, he's a treasure seeker, as we now know for a fact. I just kind of put it out there. I don't call him a con man. Mm-hmm. I mean, Brody and Bushman are on a road to somewhere very different, I would argue, from myself. It's funny, I thought at one time I should, in fact, have to write like a 70-page biography of Joseph Smith. Even to write a book about the last 3 weeks of Joseph Smith, you have to give the reader a lot of information. Like, why are you writing about this guy? What's important about him? Why is this book worth reading?
Certainly.
However, I was not working on an entry in the Joseph Smith sweepstakes. I really tried to find a middle road. Here in Salt Lake City, I've been pressed very hard and on this question, and I'm happy to keep being pressed, where people say, well, you write about these kind of extraordinary things that Joseph Smith did. Why don't you call him, for instance, a sexual predator? Well, I leave it to others to assign names to his acts. I'd like to think that my book is purely factual, and that when you add up many of these acts, you can start making characterizations.
Sure, sure. So at the end of the day, your interest was in telling a compelling story.
I think that's fair to say. And indeed, I mean, although I also knew, I knew the voice in which I didn't want to write this book, and I did not want to write this book in a voice that was derisory of Joseph Smith. It meant nothing to me.
And in my reading of it, I appreciate that because, you know, and to use a rather crude comparison, I remember what the writers of the Book of Mormon musical were saying as they were preparing that. They said, no one wants to watch a musical where you just bash on a system of beliefs for 2 hours. That's just, no one enjoys that.
Although they did allow themselves to bash on a system for 1 hour.
That's
pretty
right.
Aggressively.
That's right. You know, and as John Stewart said, you both mock religion and you celebrate religion at the same time. Now, I'm looking here on page 5 of your book, and you know, obviously this narrative, it's centered in Nauvoo, and you say that Joseph founded and ruled with a velvet fist.
I do say that.
In something of a, you know, a theocratic city-state. Can you explain to me what that would have looked like to your average person on the streets of Nauvoo, Illinois?
Well, Russell, I think you know as well, if not better than I. I mean, I even wonder if, you know, I'm certainly willing to criticize my own work. I wonder if, you know, it's the velvet fist and the mailed glove, perhaps. Although sitting here in Salt Lake City, that's a little more a typical characterization of Brigham Young, you know, his successor. I mean, I don't know. It's a charismatic city-state, right? Really ruled by an individual. I ain't no political theorist, and readers won't find political theory in my book. But I mean, I think it's clear that I list in a non-ironical manner. I mean, I list like 35 titles that Joseph arrogated to himself, and that is in fact intended as a kind of semi-comical statement, and also as a political statement. Like, how can you be the mayor, the chief justice, the architect, the chief land recorder? You know, basically, he's the bank, as you know, and he's the land bank. I mean, I mean, Nauvoo, I guess, in the Mormon tradition, is called the City of Joseph. I mean, it's the City of Joseph in every regard. I mean, I could go on, but I mean, I am quite dismissive of the trappings of government in Nauvoo, if you will. The Nauvoo City High Council, for instance. I mean, obviously, we now have the benefit of the minutes that have been published, and that, you know, he ruled supreme.
You say that if he was a megalomaniac, he came by it honestly. What did you mean by that?
Well, as I write there, I mean, from 1830, this is only 14 years. 1830, as we know, is the year that he and like 12 cousins of his basically started the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. I realize the name evolved even back then, but you know, with just a bunch of his friends who kind of believed in the Book of Mormon, which he had more or less just pulled out of a hat, you know.
No pun intended.
No pun intended. You know, and in 14 years, now, I think numbers are hard to come by, as the Wall Street Journal likes to say. But let's be realistic. In 14 short years, he is the king of the largest town in Illinois, larger than Chicago, which is on a growth spurt of its own. You know, how many Mormons are there in 1844? I really don't know. I'd be happy to guess. 30,000 in the United States? Let's say 25. Who cares if I'm wrong? How many in Great Britain? Let's say 5. Who cares if I'm wrong? Are you kidding me? He's gone from zero to 30,000 fervent adherents who are willing to literally lay down everything for Joseph, and who are not dupes in any particular way, who are not stupid. You know, it's a literate religion. From the get-go, it's as you know, again, it's a religion about record-keeping and reading. So it's an astonishing achievement. So when I say he's a megalomaniac, which is pretty clear, not only do I say it that once, but in the book it's pretty clear, I think, that that's his story in 1844. I mean, I point out where he started. You know, he started, and this is metaphorically, you know, in a tent, you know, competing with Alexander Campbell in upstate New York for followers. Now, Campbell actually, of course, did have some followers, interestingly enough. But I say it there, you know, the Millerites, the Rappites, where are they now? Question mark. They're nowhere. They disappeared.
Nobody even knows who they are, whereas with Joseph Smith.
Exactly. No one has least bit idea. You should start talking about the Millerites. They think you're talking about beer or something.
Right, right. You know, you talk about the Millerites in American memory, and it's like there is no American memory.
Precisely.
But there is one of Joseph Smith. You know, and to your comments about, you know, ruling Nauvoo as a theocratic, you know, city-state, you know, with a velvet fist. I find it noteworthy myself that a couple of years later, as Brigham Young is leading the Saints to the West, he makes a comment, and he says, "I think Joseph Smith was way too kind on you. I think he was too nice, and that's what ultimately led him to his death, and I will not make that same mistake."
That's fascinating. I hadn't heard that. Of course, it doesn't surprise anyone, does it? I mean, Brigham, I mean, I can sit here and smile because I didn't write a book about Brigham, but Brigham is, that's, there's not a large part of my book, but thank heavens there's a small part of my book that begins with this line, you know, the saints didn't follow Joseph just because he talked to God, the saints followed Joseph because he talked to them. I mean, This is interesting because this is where I have almost a complete congruence with, you know, LDS propaganda or whatever you choose to call it, meaning the church faith-affirming view of Joseph Smith. I think the church is correct, you know, when they teach young children that that Joseph had a positive, gregarious side to him, you know, a life-loving side to him, and clearly a people-loving side to him. I don't need to blather on, but
sure.
I happen to believe that's true.
Yeah, and I think that's borne out in the records. You know, everyone who commented on their initial impressions of him, it was always a positive one. No one ever came to him and said, "Wow, how on earth did this man come to be, you know, such a great leader?" Rather, said, "Oh, wow, I look at him, and it's pleasant, right? I feel drawn to him." So I think speaking about his charisma and his, you know, his love of people, I certainly think that that's a fair reckoning of Joseph Smith by my own reading.
Yeah, I'm happy that that's in, you know, in my book, and I think critics can legitimately say, well, why isn't there more of that in your book? Well, you know, my book's about a period of time in his life, and I've the more I talk about the book, certainly here in Salt Lake City, where people know the subject. I mean, I've always thought that the last 18 months of Joseph's life are a kind of a biographical time apart, if you will.
Certainly. Now, you obviously treat polygamy with, you know, with a fair amount of ink in your book. So let's talk about that, and rightfully so. Rightfully so, might I add. It's a legitimate topic, and it's one that Brian Hales has written 3 volumes of history on. You know, some people say he overwrote, but that's, you know, that's up for debate. So my question for you is, you know, the great question. The great question is, you know, Bushman, he argues that Joseph Smith didn't lust for sex as much as he lusted for kin. You know, whereas, you know, even Fran Brody said something to the effect of, you know, he was too much of a Puritan to ever really embrace libertine attitudes. So for those people who are maybe interested in reading your book, what would be a short summation of your views on how Joseph Smith saw sexuality?
Well, that's an excellent question. And it sounds like I don't really hold with either Bushman or Brody. I certainly, stop well short of using terms like lecherous conduct. Mm-hmm. I think I use the adjective priapic once in the book, which, you know, is a term that means someone who always has an erection. I use it to describe Joseph and his confederates. It's probably, you know, I just use it loosely, so to speak. But I stop well short of, you know, of calling, you know, Joseph Smith a dirty old man or whatever. I in that chapter, I think, and I'm definitely welcome to be pinned down on this. I mean, I'm definitely leaning on George Smith's work and Todd Compton's work. And I just feel, and I have that Joko serious footnote there about, you know, scholars disagree as to the number. I mean, that's straight comedy when you have Fawn Brody saying that Joseph has 37 wives and Mike Quinn says has 51 wives. Well, those are serious people. But to me, we're talking about an astonishing string of ceilings or whatever you choose to call them. And I do actually, I don't know what's manifest in the book, but when writing about these events, I do actually bring a sort of a 20th century sensibility. Mm-hmm. When I talk to Mormon audiences, or any audience for that matter, I make sure they understand that the legal marriage age, you know, in Illinois is 12, and I mentioned that in the book, so that when, you know, Joseph is, and these are my words, you know, when Joseph is coming on to the Partridge sisters or the Lawrence sisters, who are, say, 15, 16, you know, at the very least, I try to put that into historical context. I just feel like when I write about these events serially, and when I tell the reader with some degree of confidence that there were a lot of them and that they were happening frequently in, say, the first half of 1843, I'm trying to let the events and the behavior speak for itself.
Right. So the impression I'm getting from you is, you know, at the end of the day, whether we're 27, 37, 33, it doesn't really matter. The fact is that there were a lot of them.
Well, there
were happening all the time.
And I guess kin is complicated. I haven't looked at what Bushman read of late. I mean, there's kin and there's seed, right? I mean, that gets, because I always thought as a non-Mormon that, there was something about numbers, that adoption began, I believe, at this time, something I don't mention in my book, by the way, this notion of spiritual adoption. So I always thought the idea was that the larger your family network at the time of the exaltation or the end of the world, that was my impression. So then you get the question, well, is he just sealing, are these just ceilings or marriages for eternity? I mean, I don't happen to believe that. I do believe that, that Joseph was having sexual relations with many of these women. But then we open up, you know, and I do briefly address this, you know, then where's the seed? Because Joseph does talk about raising seed up to Abraham, et cetera, et cetera. It's an Old Testament quote. So right. I don't know. I mean, I'm willing to have you poke holes in what I'm saying here.
From what I understand from my reading, I draw a lot of my work from Brian Hales as well as Samuel M. Brown. You know, Brian Hales has demonstrated, and really this has been known for some time, but he's demonstrated with more certainty than we've ever known before that, you know, there were sexual relations with at least 10 to 12 of the wives. You know, there may have been several where there were not, but okay, so he wasn't having sex with 20 wives. He was having sex with 10. At the end of the day, that does tell us, okay, this wasn't some kind of an innocuous family relationship. That being said, you know, Sam Brown, in his book on Joseph Smith and death culture, he makes an interesting argument. You know, he actually looks at, you know, how death influenced a lot of Joseph Smith's theology. He said, you can sum up all of Joseph Smith's theology in the one sentence, "I will open up your eyes as regards to your dead." The title of the book is In Heaven as It Is on Earth.
Okay, so go on. You're making an interesting point, and so keep going.
Yeah, so in his book, he suggests that everything that Joseph Smith ever did, and especially polygamy, the intent was to establish a kind of enduring community, the kind of community that could transcend the bonds of death. Joseph Smith feared alienation. He feared oblivion above all else. It was
I don't disagree with any of this, by the
way.
I mean,
it was something that haunted him ever since he was a child. So in Brown's argument, he seems to think that Joseph Smith was seeking to establish lateral bonds throughout the Mormon community, hoping that he could create a network that would help help him not feel this oblivion so much anymore. Heaven was being with those that you love.
Right. No, well, if you actually look at the acknowledgments in my book, I tip my hat to that idea when I say that, you know, one of the eternal ideas of Joseph Smith's theology was that you could be with your family till the end of time, and you should read that passage because I mentioned my wife and children. I mean, I think I get that, and I think I got that. I mean, I think I address this on a less spiritual plane than Brown, for sure. Although, and indeed, I think my book falls short when, now that the book's been published and I spent more time with Mormons talking about it, I think if anything, it falls, Joseph really, I mean, the afterlife really is what Joseph promises his people. One could argue. And I only aver or allude to that. But to get to your, I mean, to get to your central point, which is still really unbelievably interesting, to be fair to myself, I don't build as elegant a structural artifice as the one that Brown does, the one you're describing. But I don't say, you know, he did it for prurient reasons. He was just trying to get his rocks off or something. I mean, I kind of go carefully there. I mean, the fact of polygamy, again, seemed really important. I mean, you know, Hales doesn't like what I've written, and sooner or later will direct his mighty howitzer against me somewhere. But that's okay.
And, you know, to be honest, that's kind of the nature of the writing biz, right? You have somebody who specializes in one aspect of one historical figure's life. So, you know, he specializes in polygamy. And then you have somebody who's saying, listen, I'm trying to synthesize things. I'm trying to tell a broader narrative. So I would expect there to be some kind of tension there. And I think ultimately it's better for readers. It's constructive tension.
It's hard to say. I was in Salt Lake when Brian's book was published, you know, on or around February 2013. And I asked Compton, whom I respect, to read my chapter in polygamy. And he did, and he gave me a lot of feedback, and he had some specific criticisms. And I didn't actually take all of his criticisms to heart. I mean, meaning I didn't make all the changes he recommended. But I'm perfectly, for the reader, you know, for the reader of my book, I tried to get somebody who knew the subject intimately to sign off on, certainly on my facts, if not on my rhetoric.
Right. No, that's, I mean, in my reading of your chapter on polygamy, I think, you know, I think you did a fair job. You know, I think it's one of those things where we're trying to, you know, or you're trying to make an accessible narrative for your average everyday reader. So I wouldn't.
Well, I also, you know, I couldn't. I know Brown is deservedly respected, but I can't go into some deep, you know, Mormon eschatological thing here. It's just not right. You know, it's not a Mormon publication, and so on.
No, it isn't. So let's talk about the events that actually led to the assassination itself. One of the long-standing questions, not only in scholarship, but also in on-the-ground Mormonism, is why, right? It's been assumed for a long time. I have to admit, even I was raised with this idea that Joseph Smith was killed just because people hated the truth. Right. They hated what he stood for, hated the message of Mormonism. And of course, you know, as you begin to be exposed to more sources, more documentation, that narrative is complicated somewhat. I mean, let me phrase the question this way. If you had to pick what the motive was for the assassination between religious principles or political ideology, what would it be and why?
Well, of course, I don't mean to be nasty, but Joseph Smith was not killed, you know, because he bore the truth. Okay, so I totally reject that. He was killed for a complicated set of reasons. I mean, there's a chapter in my book called Everybody Hates the Mormons. So I've heard this, again, I've heard this kind of Mormon default thing, oh, it was because of politics. They killed him because of politics. The Mormons were too powerful politically. That's certainly not the entire story. I do think what I call blasphemy, meaning I do write that a population of southwestern Illinois that was there before the Mormons arrived viewed the religion as totally blasphemous in every respect. I mean, now you call that, and I'm not trying to be, you call that the truth. I mean, anyway, there was definitely a religious aspect to it. I think people disagree with me, but I think there was I think this whole notion of strangeness, shall we say, definitely contributed. There were political reasons. The Mormons were politically powerful. I'm convinced there are also economic reasons. I mean, suddenly there's 11,000 people. I mean, let's be frank. Mormons work together. Mormons help Mormons. Mormons build with each other. I know some Mormons mourn the more collaborative nature of 1830s Mormonism, but even 1840s Mormonism, even 2014 Mormonism, has elements of collaboration, you know, built into the religion and the ideology, I would argue. But let's talk about 1840. Maybe I'm on safer ground there. So, you know, this group of like-minded people builds this thriving town, and they're kind of surrounded by yahoos and nobodies and Negro haters and, you know, sort of farmers. And I don't know, there's a tremendous amount of enmity between the two groups.
Certainly. And that's one sense that, you know, you even begin to get that sense from some of Joseph Smith's intimates towards, you know, the end of the Missouri era. Oliver Cowdery, for example, when he was excommunicated in 1838, you know, he sent a letter. And in this letter, he basically said that the Mormon church that he was seeing before him was no longer a Republican, small r, institution. It was no longer compatible with his self-identity as a freedom-loving American.
Do you mean politically? Is that what you're implying?
Politically, you know, that yeah. The church was trying to control too much. You know, he was trying to run a debt collection business on his own, trying to run his own business. And, you know, he was kind of using his church network to do that. And the church leadership resented that. And they said, we can't have you using our resources for running your own business. But in Oliver Cowdery's eyes, this is what it meant to be an American, to be able to run your business as you see fit on your own terms.
Well, right. I mean, this speaks to something that you raised much earlier, which is this, the total nature of Joseph's state. I mean, I do write, and I would say that the scholarship isn't adamantine where this is concerned. But, you know, Joseph's enemies also had rival economic concerns from him. I mean, most people who know this, the outlines of this story, know that one of his main opponents was this man, William Law. And I think when I talk, especially here, you know, where people know some of the cast of characters, it's always seemed to me about that. It's what's important about this story is that Law is rich. Law is a rich businessman, and Law has competing economic interests from Joseph. And that has always, you know, so that it's not like, I mean, I get that Law is also a religious dissident. I talk about this, I realize that it's important that Law is in a sense as big as Joe. I mean, if you go to Nauvoo, of course, his house is as big as Joseph's. It's quite interesting. He has, you know, he's not really that subservient to Joseph, it would seem. And that I think I probably tread lightly where that's concerned, but I think that's actually going extremely important in the interplay that ultimately leads to Joseph's death.
And, you know, when we talk about the impact of Joseph's death on June 27th, 1844, we tend to think of Joseph Smith as a coalition builder, right? Because you look at what happened following his death, right? You have, you know, the Mormon movement fracture into a number of different pieces. You know, you have the Strangites, you have the sect that his brother William Smith established. You've got the Brighamites, any number of groups. So I'm curious, how do you think Joseph Smith was able to hold together so many competing factions, even up to the last years of his life?
Okay, I mean, well, that's a fine question. But having said that, he is, after all, the prophet who created the Book of Mormon. You don't have to mince words. I mean, whether it was revealed to him or he translated it. I mean, it's, I mean, in a sense, how could it be otherwise? I guess who has an equal claim? I put it back on you, if anyone.
I mean, what comes to mind for me is, you know, you look at people like David Whitmer, where he had a faith in the Book of Mormon to the day of his death, as well as, you know, the other two witnesses to the Book of Mormon. So while they believed in the Book of Mormon, they believed in the translation, that did not necessarily equate their believing Joseph Smith after a certain point. So I'm curious about how was Joseph Smith able to hold those together that he did even to his final days?
Well, I love to dodge questions by pointing out that they're slightly out of my chronological wheelhouse, okay? But and again, to throw something back at you, isn't it a fact, as the lawyers like to say, that that the church basically exploded in Kirtland?
It did expand pretty rapidly.
No, but that's not what I mean. Wasn't there, in fact—
Explode as
yeah,
far as—
Yeah, broke into several pieces in Kirtland. Right. I mean, again, in my book, I talk about how Kirtland goes south vis-a-vis the Gentiles, but and what I don't talk about, because this is not relevant to my book, but I believe there's a significant schism in the church in Kirtland.
There is.
Okay, so, I mean, I'm pushing back a little bit on you, I guess, since Joseph wasn't always successful in holding together these broad coalitions. And hearing you talk, it makes me think, frankly, that maybe the powerful missionary work and the powerful missionary work in Great Britain might have been part of the glue that held Nauvoo together. Because, again, you and I both know, I mean, these numbers are interesting, 3,000 or more, so maybe one-third of the population of Nauvoo might have come from Great Britain. Mm-hmm. And they were, there's probably a little leakage or slippage. A low percentage probably didn't bother going up the Mississippi. But the people who did, I think, were doggedly loyal to Joseph.
So in some ways, one could argue, it was actually the geographic distance that enabled them to become first attracted to Joseph. You know, they're exposed to his writings. They're exposed to Joseph Smith, the idea, before they're exposed to Joseph Smith, the man.
Right. Although, to be fair, he reinforces the message, I think, for, you know, again, 95% of the people.
Right.
I mean, again, when I've had to talk here about, you know, the dissident movement that will eventually topple him, so to speak, indirectly, I mean, it appears to be 300 people, right? So what? I can't even do the math. It's like less than 1%.
Yeah, it's an incredibly small faction.
Right, right. A powerful, as I like to point out, because law has money. At least where Nauvoo is concerned, I mean, he does seem to have a grip on the imagination of the faithful, I would say.
So speaking to the laws, do you believe, and this is kind of the $16,000 question, feel free to dodge if you're so inclined, do you believe that Joseph Smith made a pass at Jane Law?
I do. I incorporate the counter-narrative, what I would call the apologist counter-narrative. I think it's fake, the counter-narrative.
Simple. He did make a pass.
I'll just tell you very briefly why I think it's fake, because every time Joseph is accused of making sexual advances, and I mean every time, I mean many times, and something goes wrong, he calls the woman in question a whore. Mm. He says, "Oh no, I didn't do that. She came on to me. She's a whore." Mm. I know there's this kind of semi-interesting scholarship about, was he looking for, you know, was he grooming William Law to be a husband for Emma? We're really down in the weeds here. I just simply don't believe any of it.
And so I assume you accept that interpretation for Sarah Pratt as well.
I do, actually, yes. Mm. I mean, I've since heard that Brian told me that it's completely the other way or something. Anyway, yeah.
Well, you do have the Bakenstoss affidavit saying that, well, I saw Sarah Pratt with John C. Bennett, and it ends up becoming kind of this war of words. So I'm not sure what Brian's perspective is on this per se.
I know he thinks I have Pratt wrong,
right?
Which doesn't bother me too much.
Right. It's at the end of the day, it's just one little slice of the narrative.
We'll all want to read his three-volume treatment.
Yeah, that's a lot of pages and a lot of years of work. But you know, we're getting close to the end of our podcast, Alex. But I do want to close by saying, what, you know, having written the book and, you know, really having interact with probably more Mormons than you've ever interacted with in your life, how has your perception of Joseph Smith changed over the process? What did you think before, and what do you think now?
Well, I didn't have I'll answer your question, and definitely not dodging it. But, you know, I'll tell you, I'll just say, like, let's say that the average Gentile like myself, who first of all is cognizant of Joseph Smith, which is already a tiny fraction, an absolute minority of anybody in America. I mean, let's take the Brody portrait of Joseph Smith. I mean, I was astonished on a different podcast, not this one, to hear Bushman, you know, praising Brody and praising her approach towards Joseph Smith. And I've always thought, I don't have a steel-trapped mind, but I've read Brody twice, and I've always thought she was quite sympathetic to Joseph Smith, frankly. So I don't quite know. I certainly now think he's a much more important figure in American history, but that's because I know more about him than I did. Okay, so that I would think his importance is growing. I mean, actually, I spent 2.5 years of my life working on him. You didn't ask this question, but I'm happy to answer it. I mean, I didn't believe in his dispensation when I started writing the book, and I don't believe in his dispensation now. So that's sort of easy to get past. But I don't regard it as, I mean, to be fair to myself, I don't make fun of it or regard it as fake in my book or say, oh, it's all ginned up. I mean, he was, you know, a lot of people, he was inhaling hat-making fumes. I mean, I don't say that at all. Right. You know, but I don't believe in Islam either. Okay, so I don't believe in Joseph Church.
Yeah, just because you don't accept the claims doesn't mean that you find it to be entirely illegitimate. Obviously, it resonated with a sizable number of people.
Yeah, I also find the proposition that God intervened in American history in 1821. I mean, I realize.
Wait, 1821, are you referring to the first vision?
That's what I'm talking
about.
Okay,
1820.
Okay, 1820.
That's the year that it's ascribed to.
I allow myself to make mistakes on anything that doesn't happen in 1843, 1844.
Although, I understand.
I've also been accused of making mistakes there. But anyway, I mean, it's, you know, again, that's not an outrageous proposition. If I'm a member of a church that believes that God intervened in human affairs 2,000 years ago. So, I mean, I don't, you know, I guess I am. I know a lot more about Joseph Smith now. I feel I'm better versed on the elements of his charismatic personality. I think, you know, and this is a trite, and I mean, I think he is indeed a person about whom, you know, you always walk away saying more questions need to be asked.
Mm. Josiah Quincy, as I'm sure you know, he said that Joseph Smith might be the most important American of his times. Is that true?
Well, I mean, you'd have to, I'm not an expert. You know, Daniel Walker Howe wrote this really incredibly boring book about that, you know, era of American history. I mean, I can only go, I doubt it. I doubt he is the most important American of his times, frankly. I mean, you know, what times are we talking about? Just off the top of my head.
Let's say 19th century.
Well, no, he's not the most important American in the 19th century. That was easy. I was going to say the 1840s, Sam Houston and John C. Fremont are probably more important.
So even within the very fairly narrow context of his times.
He's the most important American divine of the 19th century. He's the most important American religious leader of the 19th and 20th centuries. You know, I mean, I don't know. I realize it's not universally shared in Salt Lake City, but I have a healthy respect for the church, you know, that he helped to build, and I think it's no small thing, and you know, you can debate till the cow, oh, it's Brigham, oh, it's this guy, oh, it's that guy, but it, you know, the foundation stone is Joseph Smith.
Excellent. That's a great note to end on. We've had Alex Beam in the studio here today, a fascinating conversation on the closing years of Joseph Smith's life. Thank you again, and stay tuned for the next Mormon History Guy podcast.
Russell, thank you very much.